are in front of all of us. Now let us move immediately for the adoption of the agenda this morning, the entire program, which started at 8:30 and will today go on until 7, maybe 7:10 at the latest. So we have someone to propose the adoption of the agenda. Thank you, Honourable Mantash. Seconded by? Thank you, the Honourable Williams, whom we must thank for chairing the committee yesterday. Thank you very much, very competently as well. We also have a whip that we share with another committee, who very kindly too is assisting us this morning, the Honourable Kalako. Thank you very much. Now we have apologies here. We have an apology from the Honourable Lowe of the EFF, who is still off medically. We also have an apology from the Honourable Elvis, and we have the standing apology while he is on leave granted to him, the Honourable Kacharia. We also have an apology from the Honourable MacPherson asked if he could be 10 to 15 minutes late. And then the Honourable Tiako is away at the moment, and she will be here on Friday. So those are the apologies. I don't as yet, and I don't know if Honourable Kalaka has received it yet, but an apology from the Honourable Buyane. So maybe we can ask the ANC administrator what the challenges are in that regard. Right. On that note, we're going to move for the first documentary filmmakers association. The PowerPoint is already on the overhead, and we also have the people in front of us. Is it Mr. Desai, the DFA board member? Who's Mr. Desai? Right. Miss Squinges. How do you pronounce your name? Swingers. And it's Mr., not Miss. Get that right. And Miss Mostad. Thank you very much. You may go ahead. Who's going to be leading? And perhaps I should preface these proceedings. I've had the opportunity of going over Tuesday's proceedings, and some of you may have heard them, some of you may not have. People are not invited here to insult anyone at all. So I shall certainly, the first presenter who starts stringing out a load of insults, I will stop them, and they will not continue. That's first. Secondly, when you come here and you wish to critique, yes, that is what you can do and are asked to do. But at the same time, as all of us know, a critique is not constructive unless it offers an alternative proposal. No, look, this is not the way we would have put it. We believe in this. May we propose? And I think some of the people who've come here to Parliament in this year have forgotten that they expected to help us bring about a robust piece of legislation. And that does not come about through a string of insults. So let's avoid that in future, because I did take the opportunity of going over the work on Tuesday. So this morning, let us do critique and let us come forward with proposals. Thank you.
Sorry, out of those proceedings, who was insulted or who did the insulting?
not have heard me, I said the presenters who came here, some of them did. Well, if you like, look up the Hansard, all right? And that is not what we normally have. You've been here 3 or 4 or 5 years, and you know that we encourage people to give us proposals. Right. And I'm sure the film people will do precisely that. Thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Chair, and thanks for inviting us, giving us an opportunity to present to you today. Just before I go into who we are, I'd just like to make a quick couple of opening remarks. The new commodity today, the hot commodity, is information and knowledge, and this is part of the fourth revolution debate. It's a hot debate. The 21st century will depend on business. It's a period where business and development, indeed the realization of human potential, is now dependent on that very same commodity. When your mother and uncle are sending links to you, something has happened. Arts, history, culture, in short, the sum of all human knowledge is at stake here. To access much of this remains illegal or unaffordable to many. If you're not paying, somehow you cannot afford. Many of our people cannot afford internet, and those who are often expected to pay for everything they consume, every time they consume a piece of culture. Our proposition is that it's not only unfair, it restricts our access to our past and restricts access to our own work. It is not workable, it's not implementable. The motivation for our presentation then is we stand at the moment where there are great opportunities for blossoming of creativity, the nurturing of critical thinking, and the kickstarting of innovation in a very contextualized manner. This at present is being restricted by the present law, and this is what we aim to correct with our presentation today for the documentary, film, and TV sector in particular. There are three imperatives at work when it comes to the accessing the empowering potential of what we're talking about. Those are social, cultural, / educational, moral, political, and economic. So let me just start. We're an organization that's been established since 11 years now, and our aim is to essentially nurture and develop the interests of documentary filmmakers across the country. All of us here today are documentary filmmakers. We are not legal professionals. The extent and scope of our industry doesn't allow us to have the capacity to have lawyers at our beck and call. So we're volunteers. The documentary film genre is very unique. You will see some of the titles in front of you, The Dreams of Shahrazad, looking at the Arab Spring, The Shore Break, Alison, a very popular book, it's got a big legacy, Plot for Peace. All of these have been very successful films that have shown around the world and showcasing our country, our landscapes, political, cultural, physical. Mine has shot down, my own film was very dependent on the fact that lots of the footage from the massacre in Marikana went through the public interest, came through the public interest domain, becomes part of that domain once it came before the commission, allowing me to make the film. That said, 25% of my 5 million rand budget was spent on archive, much of which was owned by TV companies outside of South Africa. We reflect on heritage, history, mysteries, the universe, the planet. It really tells a story of ordinary and extraordinary people and communities. And in doing so, in celebrating and questioning our reality, we hope that our work is not only provides a tool of reflection, but empowers us and enriches us as a nation collectively and individually. We are made up of 177 paid up members. We employ at least 7 people per production. Our membership cycle exceeds sometimes over 250. We have a multiplier effect of at least 2.5, and we represent a very diverse and transforming group of filmmakers operating across all of our 9 provinces. We are a member of the South African Screen Federation. I actually chair that body. Mark next door to me is our deputy chair. And we have the South African Guild of Editors, and all of those people on that list, I think, will be representing all those with ticks there. The South African Guild of Actors will be presenting the South African Guild of Editors will be presenting to you. We're an active federation made up of numerous organisations across the value chain. Now, we're a non-profit and solely dependent on fundraising. Let's get to the meat of it. And the balance of things, we are very supportive of the amendment, but we do have a couple of issues. As creators of film and television works, we have an interest in the ownership of the copyright we create. On the other side, we also have to respect user rights. And in doing so, we see a critical to this debate, the symbiosis between creator and user. We want to see a situation where we're producing new work to use copyrighted material without permission or payment in certain circumstances. That's the reality if we're going to use our work, which has a large state subsidies coming from a number of departments, to be of the benefit for all South Africans. We cannot demand monetary recuperation for everything we do, unlike some of the bigger corporations in our country who are presenting, arguing that case. For example, we commonly utilize our rights to the rights to use quotations or copyrighted music, for argument's sake, film footage and other material, in order to comment on or criticize work or to illustrate a point or argument. Therefore, for documentary filmmakers and other media makers, these features of the copyright law are often essential to promote free expression, to promote creativity, to promote innovation. We have to ensure that copyright does not operate as a charter for censorship. There, for instance, we relied on a number of documents which were unearthed by the Commission of Inquiry to make Minor Shot Down South Africa's first international Emmy Award winning documentary. I think without the Commission and those things entering the public domain, it would have been impossible to make a work of that quality that garnered those amount of prizes. So overall, there's much in the bill that we support as documentary filmmakers. We want to state up front, we're not equipped to comment in much legal detail, but agree on the fact that there's some poor drafting here, identified already by many, that leads to uncertainty. And we need more certainty. We all know that. Our sector suffers from complexity and lack of certainty. There are 3 major sectors of government which we cross over regularly. There's the Trade and Industry, DTI, there's the Arts and Culture, and there's the Department of Communications. and their subsets, like the National Film and Video Foundation and ICASA. Much of the amendments to these bills do not help this complexity, and we find little chance with the task of raising the hard funds, the hard task to find the funds and make documentary. It's very difficult doing what we do. We don't do it simply for the money or the business. The business is not simply good enough to do that. We are see this as a vocation to tell stories, to create and so on. But of course, we do it for the love and the money. We are not trustafarians or independently wealthy people. We strongly support the need to update the Copyright Act to fit current uses and technologies as filmmakers. In addition to supporting the SASFED presentation, which you'll see tomorrow, we will raise our concerns specifically in relationship to the bill. There are 2 points it falls short on. And this is the amended bill. That's section 21, 1C and 5. This fails to adequately protect the interest in filmmakers owning their own copyright in the films they create. Despite some notable improvements, the bill fails to adequately protect the rights of filmmakers to make fair uses of copyrighted works without permission or payment in some circumstances. Unlike in the US, where there is a very open fair use system and there is a very rigorous and robust industry. And it seems to me that somehow the US think that they're the only ones who should have this legislation and that the rest of us can go to hell. On the screen is what we would like to discuss. What is on the screen over the next few minutes? In support of the SASFED presentation, we have highlighted a few points they will also make again. But recognize documentary has a larger focus on reuse of existing material, the right of people to reuse and repurpose to make it appropriate for them. We recognize that this will also mean that we, as creators, will need to give up some of our own rights to that. Thus, support a greater inclusion of the fair dealing provision, and ideally a system of fair use, very similar to that in operation in the United States. Documentary in South Africa is often commissioned, and who pays owns. That's the existing situation. So the rights ownership has been a large battle in our sector, where we're saying really to incentivize creativity, to be able to access the DTI rebate, the National Film and Video Foundation funding and so on, to align government incentives with the public broadcaster is critical. And therefore, we've been arguing with them to opt out of the present copyright bill. We've been doing that for the last 10 years. Now we have the opportunity, and they've turned around and said to us, well, why should we do so, really? Change the law, and we align ourselves with the law. And that's why we're here today. Big part of the reason why we're here today, because, in fact, the SABC has a huge spend, a huge part of the spend in terms of the audiovisual industry, as does Mnet, as does ETV. But until we can shift the goalposts critically at SABC, which has the largest spend, we're not going to be able to do so. Fight our battles with some of the big corporate players in the room, sitting in the room with us today. So they say ownership is vested in ownership of a commissioned work, of a cinematographic I can never get my mouth around that word, film, in the commissioning entity, resides in the commissioning entity rather than the author of the film. That's the current old Act, Section 21, 1C, has long operated to deny South African filmmakers copyrights in their work. This is an exception only for a few, there was only an exception for a few classes of creative works in which IP may vest. Others in this exception are normally specific to people commissioning. You don't commission a photograph, you don't commission a portrait or a gravure of yourself and not want the rights. But with film, we are told we are simply commissioned to meet the needs of a public TV slot and create that work itself with significant investment, our own investment. Now, we're not paid for the ideas, and ideas often take long to create, and therefore we're arguing that it's a nonsense that all the rights contained in the work should reside with the public broadcaster. Simply, they need the rights to broadcast in their territory and where they operate, nothing else. Why should they have the educational rights? They do nothing with them. Why should they have non-commercial rights? Why should they have international rights? They don't simply do anything with them. This is the problem we're faced, and this is which is holding back the development of the industry, the innovation of further works. So, where are we here? Let's move on. Okay. Commissioned films are often just shown once on television, never to be seen again because of the ICASA rules. They're trying to beef up their points. It's a ridiculous system. The filmmaker lacks the rights in the film to license it to others. They also lack the rights to continue profiting from their work, reducing the market potential of the South African films and our ability to further export. We have always argued for a default position on rights ownership based on Section 21C without contract, contrary to 21(1)(e). So other broadcasters follow the SABC. We need to address to restore the balance of power. We have always allowed for contract, the ability to negotiate individual contract to be the default position. So why repeat it as an option now? We're totally against this. We want the right to invest with the filmmaker and the default position to contract, it should be to contract. So section now, we're arguing 21C should simply be struck from the bill. Rights for all these classes should vest with the author, the creator, and the contract must transfer only if and when required. Okay, the funding reality of South Africa, this is maybe, hopefully, is about poor wording, dictates docs are made with the public broadcaster. It's seen as a social good. It's seen as a good which enriches our society collectively and individuals and people individually. Now, really, to say that, to propose that all copyright should vest in the state where it's funded by the state would therefore be a misnomer. We would argue really it's only where the state is has a majority direction. It's a very brief driven project. Would we want to see the state owning it? Otherwise, it has economic potential, which has many uses, as we know now, with the explosion of the amount of platforms available to people. We recognise the need, so it should. We suggest that it should be changed to or be changed as indicated on screen. Huh? Where are we?
Yeah.
quickly jump in there. So really the issue is that at the moment state-funded works are automatically, are conferred, every work is eligible for copyright is conferred to the state under the current scenario. So what we're saying is in the wording as it stands in the amended bill, it's problematic because it negates a large portion of the funding that we might be able to enjoy in our sector. In fact, almost all of our films, especially the documentary space, but most of our projects are funded almost entirely by organs of state. And putting this clause in would disallow any rights ownership that currently exists from funding that comes from the National Film and Video Foundation, from the DTI, from the SABC, from the various film commissions in the provinces. And I must point out at that point that the provinces are quite important in this copyright picture, something that might not have been considered, but essentially the provincial funding structures are a role player. And then it certainly would put an end to IP ownership by the South African production industry, which is so critical in terms of allowing us ownership of material and a sustainable independent industry. And it also puts an end to other investment, whether it be investment from independent sources or international or local sources that might come into the picture, because people don't want to invest in projects that aren't invested in locally by people who have an equity stake in it. So that's the basics of that.
So this clearly contradicts the whole DTI incentive scheme, really, which has identified the film and TV sector as an industry which can undergo accelerated growth, which it has because of the government incentives. We want to move on now to 18. So we want to see the change where Section 5.2 be deleted from the current Act, allowing the same copyright defaults to operate for all works. We recognise the need to create new works from existing material, and that material often held up by the monopolies, and we have to face it despite the fact that we've got a myriad, a plethora of new platforms and new channels. 90% of all content that we see on our screens are controlled by 10 multinational corporations from primarily the North. We believe that the research that we've conducted ourselves shows that 86% of the interviewees have avoided using the licensing process. 69% have been forced to limit distribution of their films because of a limited scope of licenses for material used in the film. Just too expensive. 74 licenses have only permitted limited circulation of the material that they use inside their films. So it's really constraining us. It's a very constrictive environment that we're working in, and we believe without that we can really go on to flourish and innovate further. There's lots of confusion about user rights. We are now in a new age, a digital age, where people are consuming, every one of us, and consuming in ways which defy any laws or restrictions and so on. Any one of us who've got children in this room or know young people will know what the reality is when it comes to copying, accessing music, films and so on. They are way ahead of us. Our generation was the tape cassette generation. We are now moved beyond the CD, the DVD, blah, 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 the MP2, MP3, MP4. These are the formats which have made copying much, much easier. Basically, users themselves are creators. And we want to see a situation in South Africa where creators become producers, that we allow that space where creators can become producers and achieve the innovation that they need to adapt what they need for their own context, and therefore utilize that in a real developmental fashion. We believe these are the core values are critical to ensure an enabling environment and to stop the deprofessionalization of the industry that we're faced with. And section 21, the right of quotation, section 12, general exception, section 15, incidental capture, orphaned works. For these, we'd like you to look at our written submission. These are very critical elements of the bill that impact very profoundly on our ability to create, to innovate, and to push the development agenda that we know South Africa needs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Desai, and the team, of course. I am seeing as this is somewhat different to Google, Wikipedia, and to allow the members to engage at this moment. And so, members, those who wish to engage and make comments, etc., on what we've just heard, which really is a very important point being made, and what we were intending the bill to take care of, and that is the protection of those who create. But at the same time, how do we factor in the users? So, hands up. Let's look at a couple of rounds if necessary, 2 minutes each to start. I saw MacPherson's hand first. Thank you. Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams, Honourable Esterhazen, Honourable Mantash.
Thank you, Mr. Desai. I must say I saw Miners Shut Down and I thought it was an incredibly well-made film. I think it was a disgrace that it took so long for the national broadcaster. I think it's incredible that publicly funded films, public money, are not shown on public broadcasting platforms. But I think that's a discussion for another day. But it relates to the SABC because the feeling that you have a lot of problems with the way that the SABC controls content and what it does or does not do with that content. And you're trying to, I get the feeling that you want, you know, changes to the copyright law to deal with the inefficiencies or the incompetencies of the SABC to manage its content instead of actually dealing with the incompetencies and inefficiencies of the SABC and what it does with that content. And I feel that might be problematic. I'd also like to get your view on the sale of its archives to a monopoly DSTV in or MultiChoice in the paid-for space is a monopoly. I think that is wrong, and that actually creates hurdles for people like yourselves, and less to extent than what the bill does or doesn't do. But is it correct for documentary makers to wholly profit off of publicly funded films? I mean, I understand what you do, and you do need to make a profit. But is it not better to be done more on an equitable basis than a pure transfer of rights from the public broadcaster to yourselves if they are commissioning work, than rather, you know, like we see in other government structures, a public-private partnership is, you know, joint ownership, joint, input, and joint profit from that. Then just it's going to go from here to you, and that's the end of it. Thank you.
Thank you very much. One moment. Thank you. Thank you very much, Honourable MacPherson, Honourable Williams.
Thank you, Chair. First, I just want to welcome the input. Thank you very much. My question is around when you were talking about Section 5.2, I wasn't sure I understood that. That if the DTI fund the making of a documentary, then you're saying that the ownership of that documentary then under the state. And I just want some clarity on whether I'm right in thinking that that's what you said. And if not, can you just explain that more to me? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Honourable Jester Hazen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. On the fair deal, fair use thing, anywhere where music is played, excuse me, you require the license to do so. It's where Samro and Capasso and people should have the back of the artist. But how many artists really have the time and the money to go into lengthy court cases to fight for those rights? It's really just not be done. And even if you're just a contributor, a silent contributor, you can forget about your performance or your rights to be collected by Samro and Capasso. And basically, this is not going to work in this Copyright Act, and the people that's going to suffer most from it is the authors. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable Mantash.
Thanks, Chairperson. I also wanted to find out from the presenter his attitude on paragraph 2A on slide 17. What is your attitude? What are you saying? It says copyright shall be conferred by the section of on every work which is eligible for copyright and which is made funded by and under the majority direction of and control of the state. What are you saying? What is your attitude towards this paragraph? Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Honourable Mantash. Are there any other questions or comments? Not at the moment. I think it was yourself, Mr. Desai, who said something along the lines, we have to respect users' rights. We recognise that we may also have to give up some rights as creators to have, was it fair use or fair deal? If you could just explain that, what you actually meant, because this does seem to be a thorny point. Thank you.
I just want to answer that quickly because I think that's Ms. Fubb speak to the crux of the question here. As authors, as creators, we only need be concerned really with the rights that we need in order to continue to make a living out of this industry. People are under this impression that somehow, you know, documentary filmmakers, they think Hollywood, they think big producers, cars, mansions and so on. This is not the case in South Africa or around the rest of the world, indeed. Certainly for documentary filmmakers, you know, many of us are well-qualified people, but we don't earn our market-related wages for our qualifications, that's for sure. So, really, why do we need to profit from our work so we can spend time developing new works which no one pays for? And this is the symbiosis between incentivizing a documentary filmmaker that a healthy and thriving documentary film industry is also a healthy and thriving public broadcaster. We're able to raise the quality of the work so we can not only entertain, but more importantly, inform, educate, and inspire. And to do all of these four things, to entertain, inspire, educate, and inform, is a very skilled work which demands lots of time to think through the ideas and so on included in the works to develop on that. Now, there are the first question which was raised, my colleague from from the honourable members. My colleague Mark Swingers will deal with.
Thanks, Riad. The Honourable McPherson mentioned, was speaking about the issue about the SABC and about rights ownership and why it is that we want to have rights ownership in our sector, specifically from the SABC. I think it's important to remember that the SABC is in themselves, firstly, a state entity, and they have the rules of Public Finance Management Act that apply to them. The argument that has existed in our industry for many years, in fact, for two decades that I've been in lobbying with the SABC, has been the argument that they have to fall within the default of law. So the Copyright Act Section 21(1)(c) has been critical in their argument to say that they should have all ownership of content. And I think it's important for us to now redress that imbalance that exists uniquely to South Africa with antiquated and apartheid-era legislation that, quite frankly, unfairly sits with the public broadcaster in terms of and the only way to deal with that is to change the balance completely and, like with other creative rights categories, remove the default position of commissioner owns IP or owns corporate copyright and turn it around. If they wish to contract the opposite, that's fine. They can do so, but it will immediately give our industry sector and organized industry in particular, and with the various members of SASFED, a position, a lobbying position to be able to push for that change, that much needed change, and do away with the argument of default position and must apply that the broadcast has been running for the last two decades. And so it's absolutely critical in that respect that we, that is the reason why we're so passionate about this section 21(1)(c) being dropped in its entirety from the Act. It is absolutely fundamental. And the other point is that if one looks at the international norms in terms of rights ownership, irrespective as to what genre you're looking at, ours is an unusual case where by default those rights rest with the Commissioner. That is not the default in most countries in our sector. Either industry has managed to successfully lobby, and our organized industry has been weak in that respect to be able to lobby for that change. In the UK, PAC did it very successfully and managed to lobby an override in terms of the Copyright Act, which has now been amended in the Copyright Act to meet that reality, and it's the same in many other countries. So our position of weakness needs to be overturned, and that's critical. Then in terms of the viewing of archive or the sale of archive material, I'm not sure that it is specifically relevant to this particular forum, but in essence, yes, our industry is deeply concerned about public broadcaster sale of archive material to a pay TV platform.
I want to come in there because I joined the case against the SABC in terms of my company, the sale of the archive or the access for Mnet to the archive. We think the archive is a public good. This is many, many decades of visual material which belongs first and foremost to the country. 500 million is a fire sale, really, when it comes to this thing, and we really want to see it investigated. But the archive here, where it connects to our discussion today, is BBC, for instance, has put huge swaths of its own archive under the Creative Commons license, to saying this is part of the Commons, it needs to be part of the Commons, and people can use it and reuse it for non-commercial purposes. And this comes back to your other question around the issue of the profit. We are not in this, you rarely get a hit and allowing you to make a few hundred thousand rand profit if you're a filmmaker in South Africa. For Leon Schuster would be a few million, and he's the only person who really makes any money in this country out of film. Let's get it, get our context correct. But if work is state funded, a lot of it, DTI rebate and so on, and here we're talking about DTI will not you do not qualify for the incentive unless you own the IP in your work, unless you're able to exploit it. Now, how you use that IP is a very important question, because for us as documentary filmmakers, we would like to see our works distributed in schools as part of the library system and so on, that non-commercial rights should be freely available to our country. It's ridiculous that they're not, that these great African works from our continent are locked up by those companies that sought to buy up these films that have been publicly funded in large part. I won't name names, but they're presenting here later this afternoon as a strategy to take out the competition and in the process undermine our very culture, our art, our expression, our history. This is wrong. It cannot be allowed to continue in this way. The question of core competencies, yes. I mean, it's not the fact that they're incompetent. It's that their core business is to serve the South African public. It's to serve the underserved in our country, the role of the public broadcaster. Now, I wouldn't be able, if I had to go into a deal with a public broadcaster to get a few hundred thousand rand, you know, 5-10% of the investment for my film, they would have wanted me not to have the right, for instance, to produce DVDs. And I think it was critical with a film like mine and Shotgun and other types of film I make, and I'm able to produce DVDs, I'm able to compete with the pirates because I can. I can produce 1,000 at 20 rand a copy, and I can go up there to Marikana and I can have the film dubbed in the language, if it's, you know, respective languages. We had it dubbed in Kombase Afrikaans as well for the farm workers, and give it to people and pay for the cost of the reproduction. So we don't lose, but people are able to access the work. We're not gaining in any significant way by competing with pirates, but that's the way we've got to work. We've got to adapt to the market conditions. So that's how we work. When we've got something popular, I don't want a substandard copy going around doing the rounds. I'd rather produce and have it sold at the same price that the pirates are selling. And actually, we can do that now. So, you know, our motivation, rationale, is the most important thing is for our work to be seen and to be used. The more, the merrier. The work is not completed until it's viewed. And that's the importance of these types of works.
If maybe I can just conclude that section of the argument, just in terms of the growing multi-channel environment that we're moving into. It's also increasingly important for rights not to be owned just by one channel, because that prevents the opportunity of a content flowing to a broader market or broader audience in an increasingly multi-channel space. And certainly industries which have not had a case where broadcasters by default own rights have been very prolific in the way in which they've managed to make content work in a multi-channel space. Then just to answer the question with regard to the proposed changes to or Section 5.2 and dealing with the issue of ownership by the state. So our understanding and our interpretation, and we have kind of sought as much advice on this as possible, is that the proposals that are now in place are problematic in terms of almost all sources of funding from government, and would certainly be problematic in terms of one of the major sources, which is the DTI's production incentive. Currently, that production incentive is one of the very few sources of equity ownership by the independent production sector that is open to us to make South Africa's film industry and television industry competitive in the global space. And to compromise that would be extremely problematic. I don't think it's the intent of the Act to do, or the bill to do that, but it certainly in its current interpretation will do just that, because by default, yes, the DTI would become owner of the funding that they provide, which is in it flies in the face of that. So our proposal is to change two pieces of wording, and the wording, if one looks at it, is yeah.
Right. The system just can't cope. To go a bit slower, because what
sure.
you're now saying, we really want to capture.
Sure.
All right?
Sure. So the issue is that our proposal I put on the screen is simply to change the wording. At the moment, the wording reads funded by or under the direction or control of. And this is the problem area, is because it's been changed. The bill proposes changing of this wording to make that funded by or under the control. Now, I don't think anyone has a problem with the idea of the state where they are directing something. And the point is, what is directing? So directing would be kind of, well, I have a need for an education department, for example, to do a particular promotional video for argument's sake, or something that kind of captures the country's anti-HIV messages or something like that. Particular brief that is given out on tender, and that you comply with those briefs requirements. In that case, you are ultimately controlling and you're giving direction to the production. But purely funding, in other words, the use of the word or, is problematic here the way we read it, because it allows all funding sources from government to essentially be automatically regarded as copyright being conferred. And it goes further to confirm what conferred means. It says conferred means that it's owned by the state organization in question. And so ultimately, what we're saying is it should be funded by and under the majority. And the reason why we put majority direction there is because broadcasters typically regard themselves as partially controlling and partially creatively directing, because a commissioning editor might say, well, I've been involved in the process of directing this project because I've given input to it on a creative level. They might say, well, we're involved in the cost controlling of the project. So the argument has been with a broadcaster when they put out a request for proposal, for example, are they giving substance to the ideas that are being brought in, and at what level? To avoid that argument, we are kind of saying, by merely saying majority, it's very clear.
I think the
you know, you've got 3 minutes.
Okay. The very last issue, I think, which is, we haven't dealt with everything the honourable members have raised, but I think the fair use argument needs to be taken on, because I think there's a dissonance here, really, between musicians and where we work with musicians directly and the publishing houses and the collecting agencies. Because any musician, particularly now, will want their work out there. Now, any musician who's working with a company who own the project, independently control it, will know that they cannot get the work flighted without filling in a music cue sheet. And that for every time that film or documentary or program shows, wherever in the world on a broadcaster, they will be gaining royalties. Now, that's where most working musicians, full-time professional musicians, earn their bread and butter. The income they earn from royalties, whether it's needle time or through particularly composers and film composers in particular, it's through TV broadcasts. This is the industrial side of the equation. So to say that somehow that the fair use, where we want to criticise or use a piece of music to comment, to make it a part of the creative work, rather than to use it as part of the creation, if you like. you have to understand the difference here, the subtlety and the nuances in the use. We are not in favour of fair use where it undermines the fundamental economic value of the work. Not whatsoever. These are our fellow creators. We need musicians. We need composers in order for us to be able to do our work properly, and we need them to be thriving. We don't need them to be scrabbling around for a living or dying of poverty and so on. We cannot get a thriving industry, film and TV industry, without composers and so on. So don't get us wrong on that score. But what we're saying is you cannot price like software. We know what government's done in terms of adopting open source software. So software can be adapted and made more appropriate and so on. We know what government's done in terms of its support for infrastructure, internet infrastructure and so on. These are about being able to create better and more nuanced works which are more useful for people and have the ability to export and build industries. That's what we're about, development.
Thank you very much, Mr. Desai and the team there. I think if there are any other questions, and this was a very succinct presentation, thank you for that. You also dealt with a number of critical factors in this bill and concepts. We will come back to you in writing, and we hope you'll respond in writing. And if necessary, as we move on in the bill, we may ask you to return. Thank you very much. Members, we're now going to move on to, I'd like Google and Wikipedia sitting up here. Wikipedia, media is it? Media. I'm still in the mode of encyclopedia, I'm sure. All right, we have Google in the front and then Wikipedia, media. Media at the back. Yeah, right. All right. Yes. And it seems that the computers are working very effectively today. All right. People aren't making a noise, so I'm sure we can begin straight away. And we've got in front of us here Mr. Hwili Sibanda, you will be pleased to learn that I now can see very effectively, very, very. My vision is no longer 37 on the left and 10% on the right. It's closer to 50 and 12. So this time I can see you very clearly. So thank you very much. I see you here on your own, and then Wikimedia is Mr. D. Scott. Is that right? Won't you carry on?
Good morning. Thank you very much, Chairperson, and to the honourable members here present. Thank you for giving us this opportunity to come and make our input on this very important bill. I will ask your indulgence a bit. I'm a bit under the weather, so my voice could be trailing. Do let me know if I'm now not clear enough. Okay, so what I want to talk about is I've been sitting through some of the presentations and some of the discussions that we've been having already on this bill. I think quite a lot of it, unfortunately, is misinformation. A lot of it, to be honest, is incorrect about some of the concepts that are contained in the bill. So I thought that I should spend my time talking a bit more about technology in general and the opportunity that it presents to South Africa and to the South African creative industry. And then I will limit my comments to only three parts of the bill. I think it's in order to say congratulations to the DTI. The bill has come a very long way. And I think it's a definite improvement from where we started. There's still a bit to be done, but I think we're in the right path. So I think I will dedicate the first part of my presentation discussing how Google fights piracy, because some of the talk around here has been sort of bordering on technology is going to disadvantage or take the artist's lunch, and I want to actually prove that it is wrong. A lot of it is unbased fears. So I'll take you through a few slides around our approach to piracy. We've got five principles that we follow when it comes to how we fight piracy. The first one of them is to create more and better legitimate alternatives to piracy. This is very important because piracy, we believe, piracy comes about when legitimate alternatives are not available. So it's very important that if you put out a work of art or a piece of music or a film, you should make it available through whether the offline or the online channels. We've got a perfect example of Netflix here in South Africa that I think before they came to the market about 6-7 months ago, I think almost 90% of the Netflix accounts we had in South Africa were pirated. They were via VPN and all of that stuff. But as soon as Netflix came to South Africa, most people changed their accounts from using VPNs or using their brother's name in the US to actually local South African accounts. And this is very important. Make the product available and then you will sort of cut off piracy. And we're seeing this especially in the music industry with these young boys that are doing hip-hop in South Africa. When they release their songs, they put them on iTunes. Mm-hmm. And that stops immediately people going around and and downloading it illegally. Okay, the second thing is follow the money. And this is a very important principle. Most of these pirate sites are actually commercial ventures. They're trying to make money out of someone's hard work. So what you need to do is to kill off the source of the money. And I'm going to show you how at Google we do this. And once you kill off the source of the money, those pirate sites will collapse. The third thing is be efficient, effective, and scalable. In this instance, I'm just going to talk about our approaches to this, about how we actually have got scalable and efficient processes of clamping down on piracy. Fourth is guard against abuse. Unfortunately, in as much as we try to fight piracy, there are also instances, whether for competition reasons or for political reasons, there are people that claim piracy, that claim copyright for copy that is not theirs. At times, maybe just to stop a competitor, or maybe the competitor is saying something that they don't agree with politically. So you can just go and say, they're using my copy, put them down. So this takes us 2-3 steps back in the fight against piracy. The fifth and last issue, principle with us is provide transparency. And this is very important. What we do at Google is we have a transparency report which we publish every 6 months. In those 6 months, we show you how many copyright claims we've received and from who and how many have been resolved. And this is very important so that everyone concerned can see what we're doing. It's nothing underhand. And then I want to talk about our approach in numbers. These are very big numbers. I'm just going to sweep through them. In terms of the money on the first column, the dollars that have been generated on our platforms, up to $7 billion been generated on Google Play. This is the amount that we actually are paying developers around the world. These are global figures. Unfortunately, I don't have South Africa-specific ones. And up to $3 billion have been generated for the music industry alone on YouTube. Remember, music constitutes less than 12% of our content on YouTube. So this figure is actually quite substantial. And up to $2 billion that has been generated through a system that we call Content ID. I'll go into depth a bit about this because it's at the core of how we protect artists and creatives' copyright online. In terms of the resources, we've got a database of digital fingerprints of all content that's close to 58 million. I'll explain how this works again much later. And we've got up to 8,000 partners that we work with that either claim copyright on themselves or on behalf of their members. And this number is very important, considering that we're a big global company operating in, I don't know how many countries now, We take up to 6 hours to take down copyright infringement claims. So 6 hours is the time that we take to resolve most of these issues. And if you look at the number just across, 98% of all those claims have actually been resolved, which means it's just about 2% that's not resolved. And then in terms of money, we have disapproved up to 670,000 accounts online that are trying to actually do advertising using other people's copyrighted content. That's quite a substantial amount, and this ties back to the issue about following the money. Now, our flagship copyright protection technology that we have is called Content ID, or CID in short. What we simply do with CID is that a rights holder uploads their content online, and then we put a digital fingerprint to it. So if someone puts it online and tries to change it or change the shape or change the name, the digital fingerprint stays with it. So it's able to be identified wherever it goes. And then what we do is we match that digital fingerprint against what other people, there could be fans that are trying to upload as well online. And if we see that what they're uploading is part of what the rights holder has already put in, we match those and then we act depending on what the rights holder says. Most of our rights holders, they've got, actually all of them, they've got three options. They can decide to monetize on the content that's being uploaded by someone, or they can decide just to track and see how that content is performing, or they could block it altogether. So they give us this information ahead of time. And what we have realized most of the time is that 90% of the time, these rights holders, they leave that content on and monetize on it. So what they're simply saying is, okay, you put my content online claiming to be yours, but since we know that this is your content, you're going to make money off of it. So they just let you upload it, and they get the money from it. So that's what we have seen. This is simply just a simplified imagery of how Content ID works. So on the left-hand side is what the rights holder, the original creator of the web does, uploads, and then we put an ID to it. And then on the right-hand side, we've got fan uploads and mashups. You know, fans are making quite a lot. I think Desai said it earlier that fans are now also creators. They make memes, they make parodies, they make sketches based on the original work of the artist. So because the artist owns the IP around that, we allow the original artist to actually make money off of that, using that system. And people are clever, by the way. They can take your content and try to maybe flip it, as you can see in the images, or turn it into black and white, or change the color, or shift the ratios. But our system, our Content ID, is able to actually match because we put a digital fingerprint to it. So even if you change the name or make it black and white or make it dark or whatever, we're still going to be able to identify it. But the system is clever enough to also differentiate that similar works of art or similar creations are not necessarily all yours. So as you can see in the images that I put there, they look similar, but they're not the same. So all these images may have been created by a different person. So our system is able to actually differentiate this and not punish other people because it looks the same, even though it's not the same. This is just an image of how the Content ID works. And I talked about the issue of scale. So these are the numbers when it comes to how the Content ID system works at scale. I did mention that we've got up to 8,000 plus partners that represents millions of rights holders. This includes broadcasters, movie studios, record labels, your one-hit wonders, your service providers, and independent creators. And we've got up to 58 million files that we use as reference files in our database, and up to 600 years of audiovisual reference material that we compare the content as and when it comes in. And this mainly works on our main platform, which is YouTube. It's got a lot of reference files, as you can see. We've had, obviously, people come to us in the times with very, you know, hilarious results. At times there have been incorrect claims of copyright. At times there have been mistakes on claims of copyright. I think the funniest was one broadcaster, they were doing a documentary on the moon landing. Remember that video that NASA put on the moon landing? So NASA put that as being in the public domain. Anyone can use it anytime. So this broadcaster did the video, including the moon landing sequence. And then they claimed, they put copyright, obviously, on the documentary. What they then did was that they mistakenly also tagged the moon landing as their own production, to the point that they took down NASA's video for the moon landing. This happens, but these are anecdotal cases, but it just goes to show how the system works and there are ways of correcting it. In some instances, there is actually a referee, an expert, a copyright expert, who is doing a documentary on the English Premier League and saying they must be more stricter on how they control their copyright. That video was actually taken down by the Premier League for infringing copyright, which is a bit strange. But we do get quite a lot of these things, but it just goes to show that the system is not yet perfect, but the system is working, and it's working at a very global scale. And then on our YouTube page, we've got curriculum on copyright. So everyone who signs up, you are shown this page on curriculum, and you have to go through it before you can start loading. So this is not a wild west where anyone can just take things and put them there. And we've got steps and measures and punitive processes as well. So for example, if you violate copyright or you get a takedown notice on your YouTube channel, you get what we call a strike. A strike is 3 strikes and you're out. We disable your account totally, in whatever ways that you call it. So if you get that strike, you have to go through the curriculum. There's an online exam that you have to go through. There's curriculum that you have to read and go through and pass the exam. Then you can remove the strike on you, provided that you don't violate again in the next 6 months. If you violate again, that's your second strike. If you violate for the third time, we take down your account. So these are systems and processes that are already built in that we try to enable the users to enjoy the content but also protect the rights holders from having their content being abused. And then the next most important thing I want to talk about is search. Obviously, search is at the center of, I think, how most people access content online. And unfortunately, obviously, people are going to use search for other things, like look for illegal content or maybe look for or put up content that is copyrighted and it's not in their name. And we've got ways in which we deal with this. The first thing that we have noticed, according to our records, is that when it comes to search, only about 14% of the queries that we get globally are potentially searches that are looking for pirate sites. Only about 14%. If you take into account that we get up to 4.5 billion searches a day, so it's only a tiny, tiny bit of people that are looking for that, but we've also got ways of dealing with that content online. We don't just let it go. There are ways that we do, that we deal with it. The first tool that we have for rights holders is this copyright removal web form. What happens is if you feel there is a website that is appearing on Google search that is leading to that contains material that is copyrighted and they are using it illegally, you can fill in this form. It's a flow process. You fill in, you give us URLs and what content exactly that they are putting there that is not theirs, and then you submit to us and then we act on it. Remember, I said it takes about 6 hours for us to resolve these queries. So it's something that we really are careful about and something that we really want to act quickly on. To date, in the last year alone, I'm not going to try and read this number, not in Parliament. It's just 2.8 billion. I've seen not so good examples. 2.8 billion. I'm sorry I said that. 2.8 billion URLs have actually been removed from our search page because they lead to potentially copyright infringing websites. And we actually have got media examples where copyright infringing websites like Pirate Bay and Torrent Freak, they actually said we don't need search engines. People that need, that want to access pirate sites, they actually don't search for them. They know them. They pass this through word of mouth or through their own, you know, platforms and stuff like that. These are habitual infringers, so they know how to get to them. So these are maybe the few in the long tail that are trying to experiment on how to get pirate websites, but we've removed all of this. And these are some of the figures. I'm not going to dwell much on them. But some of the things that we've done over the time is before that, before we, and this is almost 10 years ago, as you can see, that's an old Google logo. Before that, when you search, for example, for something like Sweet Home Alabama download, these are some of the results that you'd get. On the first link, you can see that the first link is Sweet Home Alabama MP3 download free music. Obviously, there's something wrong with that website and with that link, and we have realized it. That's why our search results now, if you search for Sweet Home Alabama, the first link that you get there are legit websites that are actually selling this music. So, for example, the result you'd get right now is iTunes. And this goes back to the point I was making, that make sure that this content is available legitimately in legit websites where people can get it. So we've removed all suspicious-looking websites from our search results and put only the legit ones where you can actually buy the content if you want it. And we've cleaned up all the results as you get them. I'll give you just a few global examples before I show you the local ones. So, for example, right now, there's a website called trends.google.com. You should play around with it and see it yourself. You put search parameters and see how many times one is searched instead of the other. So, for example, right now, if you search for Katy Perry, you see that Katy Perry was searched for 14,800 times more than Katy Perry free downloads. This tells you something about what people are really looking for. They are looking for Katy Perry, they are not looking for free downloads. In the same token, Game of Thrones is searched for 784 times more than Game of Thrones free downloads. Again, it shows you people are searching for genuine content online, they are not searching for free downloads. And then I managed to put in just a few local examples here. If you compare right now a search result for Stimela, you know, the late Ray Pierce group, I just put in the search parameter for the last 30 days. You see that on the 12th of July, that's the day when Ray Pierce passed away, that's why there's a spike. But even on that day, 100 people searched for Stimela the band. They are looking for information when only 14 of those searched for Stimela MP3s. Okay, so this tells you again the trends of what people are using search for. They are looking for genuine content about issues. They are not looking for free MP3s. I use the same example again for the young ones who may be sitting here among us. Someone like Casper Nyovest, right? On this day, I think it's somewhere around April, 84 times more people searched for Casper Nyovest, and only about 9 searched for Casper Nyovest free MP3. And you'll ask yourself, why around the 18th or 19th of April? That's the day that Casper Nyovest released his single, Kitombowen. So it's all of this is information that you can get. And as an artist, you can actually see that, okay, this is what people are searching for. So if people are searching for me on the day I'm releasing, you should also make sure that you put your content on the website where they can actually buy it. It's very useful information. Thank you for that. And then I just want to dwell on 3 points that I want to talk about with specific reference to the bill. I think in the past few days, and I think since the bill came out, actually, the issue of fair use and fair dealing has really gone the rounds. And I think it's very, very unfortunate because there's a lot of, I think, a lot of fear-mongering around fair use and fair dealing, and I think most of it is misinformed, whether deliberately or genuinely, I'm not sure why. But really, fair use is not about using people's content and not getting them paid. That is not fair use. That is piracy. Fair use is nothing like that. Some of what we have heard here already. So fair dealing and fair use, the two phrases.
I'm going to interrupt you so that I can guide your time.
Yes.
And I know you've got a colleague there. You've got a maximum of 10 minutes, so
yes.
Call it 9 minutes.
Yes, I'll be done. Thank you, ma'am. I'll be done. I didn't know that I talked too much. So, these two phrases, fair dealing is a closed list of specific exceptions, right, as we know it. And fair use is an open and flexible exception to accommodate new ideas and new technologies. So, both systems can work together, and a hybrid approach can actually work together, and it's still fine. From our submission as Google, we have a preference for an open and flexible approach to this, but if the proposal, as we are seeing currently in the bill, is towards a hybrid system, we still think it's fine. We don't have much of a problem with it. The problem we are having is some of the things that are being said against fair use, they are actually not really accurate when you look at it. Fair use helps creators by allowing them to depict real life, to respond to other works. If you look at an example of a film like, a program like Trevor Noah's Daily Show, right, if there was no fair use in the U.S., Trevor Noah's Daily Show would actually be violating up to 30, 40 copyright infringements per episode. Fair use actually allows Trevor Noah to actually take a snippet from MSNBC, from CNN, from Fox, for commentary, so that he can make the point that he's making and move on. Fair use does not substitute the need for people to watch CNN or to Fox or MSNBC. It's just for commentary and the snippets, and he moves on. Fair use allows other creators, actually, as Mr. Desai said, to use old content, such as the SABC archives, to make more documentaries. But that doesn't substitute for the value of the original program. That is very important. Fair use helps innovation. I've heard before in the past few days that people are talking about fair use. They're saying fair use is only for technology. In fact, when you look at it, fair use allows people to innovate. Some of the biggest innovations we've seen have benefited artists more than technology companies, or equally as technology companies. If you look at VCRs, if you look at MP3s, the advent of the Sony Discman, the advent of the iPod player, this has actually led to more music consumption, which would translate to more dollars for creators. So all of this is innovation that is enabled either fair use in terms of creative works or software engineering, which allows innovation, and it goes down the line to develop the economy, to develop creators, and so on and so forth. Fair use helps free expression. I think we know the Universal Declaration of Human Rights about everyone's rights to cultural expression, to enjoy the culture of the society that they are in. It allows people to be able to comment on things without being censored. This is from a research from CCIA Net. I can make this research available to the committee if you want it. It's looking at the fair use industries and their contribution to the American economy. And if we are talking about the fourth industrial revolution here in South Africa and how to develop the economy, these are some of the opportunities that some of the countries have actually benefited from fair use industries. Fair use is not a license for piracy. Fair use only applies when a user adds value to copyrighted material without invading the rights holder's market. The moment they invade the rights holder's market, or they are substituting for the original rights holder's content, then they are pirating. We are talking about fair use where you are not substituting for the original work of art. With fair use, authors will still get paid. Fair use is predictable and reliable. It is a common law system, and there's a lot of precedents. Fair use isn't just for lawyers. I know some here have said that it's highly litigious, and in fact, in the U.S., between 2009 and 2007, there were only 7 fair use trials. And also remember, when people are saying this is only for people that have got luxury of lawyers, let's also remember that the bill is proposing the setting up of a tribunal to adjudicate some of these things, okay? Fair use isn't just American. We've got countries like Israel, Singapore, Poland, and South Korea that are using this fair use system. The second issue that I want to talk about in the bill is the remix, is the inclusion of a remix exception. I think the bill would be richer if we included a non-commercial remix exception in it. I've got here, these are just snapshots of the African Digital Network Art. These are people that are actually taking other pieces of art and they are remixing and creating new works of art. This is remixing, and this is some of their own testimonies that even in African culture, our creation, our music, our song, our dance wasn't just born from you. You took it from the community, you remixed it, you put your own flavor, your own language, and your own differences, and created a new work. That's how it's always been. You build on other works of art. Of course, some artists create from scratch. We understand that. And you asked us the other day that we should include language that we want to suggest. This is, I'm not going to read this paragraph, but this is the exact wording that it's taken from the Canadian law on non-commercial remix exception. This is possibly language that the committee may want to look at. The last thing, and I'll quickly zip through this, is linking in the public rights to communication. We need to make a distinction between someone who's providing a link and someone who's actually disseminating copyrighted information illegally. And I think the bill would be better if we have legal clarity on this issue. Linking is, that's how the internet works. The internet works through links, all right? And if I link to something and it turns out that something is, that website is using illegal or copyrighted material, I may have secondary liability, but primarily the offender is the person who put that information online. This is what we call the server test. This is what we call the server test, where the content resides. That person's server is, this person is the one who's actually infringing. And we need to make that very clear in the bill, and we're not seeing it right now. So we seek legal clarity on the bill. We want the bill to be able to say, providing information about where to find the work is not a communication right to the public. A communication right to the communication to the public is done by the person who is actually transmitting that work, the person who uploaded it online. So I think with those, I will take questions or be guided by you, Chair.
Thank you very much. You've had a minute over, so well timed.
Thank you.
All right. And then we move on then to Wikimedia. Is it Mr. Scott?
That's right, yes. Wikimedia South Africa. Chair, I would like to know if I could make a 360-degree video recording of this. I'm going to allude to this later in my presentation.
Yes,
because
you've got a video here.
Yes, yes, as well. That's right.
Honourable MacPherson, this is where our rooms will now have to be reviewed because they're behind the technology.
Thank you, Chair. So yes, I'm from Wikimedia South Africa. Wikimedia South Africa is a representative body, a volunteer representative body. We represent Wikipedia editors in South Africa. We have a close working relationship with the Wikimedia Foundation, who actually run the service that Wikipedia is based on. And we obviously have connections with other chapters around the world of Wikipedia editors. I'm here to present on one specific topic, and that's in freedom of panorama, and how it affects us as editors, but also how it affects each and every one of us here in this room as members of the general public. I'm going to start off with a story of how this became a very important issue to us as a chapter. Back in our early years when we were first established, we were a bunch of unpaid volunteer editors, very enthusiastic, who want to improve the quality and the quantity of South African-related content on Wikipedia. And in an effort to do that, we adopted a project called Wiki Loves Monuments, originally invented in another country. We decided to bring it over here, and with the intention of recording all South Africa's monuments, or as many as possible, take photographs of them for use on Wikipedia to illustrate important events in South African history, important places in South Africa on Wikipedia. And we were very innocent. We were running around taking photographs, and then we were informed by some of our better informed members as we were running this competition that the competition's fine, but we cannot accept or take photographs of recently built works of public art. So this meant that monuments built beyond a certain date, typically life of the author plus 50 years, which means that monuments built to celebrate the struggle against apartheid were excluded. So it creates this perverse situation whereby we could Yes, essentially, because of the way the old act was written. And I'll get into the details of how they came to be. But the picture you're looking at here is a picture of the Guguletu 7 memorial in Guguletu. It was taken by one of our members as part of the competition. We really were hoping to use it on the Wikipedia page for Guguletu 7 memorial in all the different languages. Unfortunately, I've censored it out here as an illustration to show that we cannot use this picture on Wikipedia. We can use it on an individual page basis if we argue fair use, but fair use in this country obviously is still being debated. Additionally, because of the way Wikipedia operates, it becomes very onerous in that you have to argue on a Wikipedia article by Wikipedia article basis, which essentially means it becomes a form of private censorship if we are not allowed to simply upload it to something called Commons. I'm just going to move on to the next one. Now, this image of the Voortrekker Monument, we could use it because it's older than Life of the Author plus 50 years. The Wikipedia community has got a policy of taking the strictest possible interpretation of copyright law, which means that although the old act allows for something called fair dealing, it didn't make Freedom of Panorama explicitly okay, which meant that what we were doing, taking photographs of public works of art and sharing them over the internet, landed up in a legal gray area, which hasn't been tested in South Africa. It's been tested in a few other countries, one of which is Sweden, where the decision was taken by the Swedish chapter to purposely test it. They took a photograph, or actually it was a regular volunteer who took a photograph of a monument. He put it up on Wikipedia. The owner of the monument, who was a museum, demanded it be taken down. Wikimedia Sweden, along with the community there, elected to test the law because it was a grey area. They lost. The chapter had to pay, I think, 75,000 krona, Swedish kronas, and there's a demand to retract the image. This is a bit of an awkward situation because the image actually sits on servers in America, so although you can retract it from Swedish Wikipedia, can you retract it from English language Wikipedia, et cetera, et cetera. That in itself is a legal gray area, right? And it's all because of a lack of Freedom Panorama. I want to say one more very important thing about Freedom Panorama. Freedom Panorama was invented to protect the rights of artists. It was invented to protect artists. I'll get to the specific example a little later in my presentation of when it was and how it was protected to invent artists. But needless to say, this is an incident, the Swedish incident, where we can argue it didn't protect artists, it didn't really protect anyone, it didn't protect the interests of the general public. So I'm going to the next one. Now, Freedom of Panorama is not a new concept. It's also not an unusual concept. It's becoming increasingly common around the world for countries to include Freedom of Panorama clauses in their copyright legislation. The map you see before you has got countries in dark green, which have got a very stringent, or very broad rather, Freedom of Panorama clauses, a very generous one, such as the UK, India, Australia, New Zealand, Austria, which invented the term. What I mean by broad is that they allow for both public photographs in open spaces of public artworks, as well as photographs in closed public spaces of public artwork. The light green ones are, you know, slightly less broad, sort of allow for in open areas and three-dimensional works of art, and the ones in yellow are places which just allow for outside photographs, public, outside of buildings. Red is where Freedom Panorama does not exist. South Africa does not have Freedom Panorama. Because of that, we can't share pictures of national monuments, recently built national monuments, in Wikipedia, which we feel is deeply unfortunate. A few examples of how Freedom of Panorama editors, but also the general public. So let's say, for example, you're a citizen sharing a photograph of a statue that you just took. You just took a photograph of, say, the Nelson Mandela bust in front of Parliament, and now you want to share it with your friends on social media. Intuitively, this seems perfectly reasonable. And this is why when we were doing the Vuhilas Monuments project, when we were first told of this lack of freedom panorama in South Africa, we attempted to contact the owners of the public works of art to get their permission to use it on Wikipedia. Because, firstly, you know, it's intuitively obvious that you should be allowed to do this. So when we approach people, like municipalities, that, you know, can we get your permission? They just look at us like, why are you asking? Of course you can. But they don't really want to give us a legal letter. Also, like, who do you ask in the municipality? Do you go to the legal desk? Is there a legal desk? Do you go to someone else? Do they have time? Do they think it's a worthwhile cause? Very difficult to get any feedback from them. Additionally, it can create a situation whereby, let's say, you're the owner of a building and you really don't want people taking pictures of the facade of your building. It can lead to a type of private censorship, so people can deny your ability to share the image over the internet. They can't necessarily deny you taking a photograph of it in a public space, but distributing it is another matter. Now, back to the example of the bust of Nelson Mandela in front of Parliament here. I saw a couple of members here today doing that, which is intuitively fine. I myself have done it and shared it on social media, but it's a legal gray area. I mean, that bust recently installed is owned by Parliament. I would assume it's owned by Parliament. Therefore, we'd need permission from Parliament to share it over Facebook or Twitter or these sort of media platforms. The other example, artists selling paintings. Now, Freedom Panorama was invented in Austria originally to protect the rights of artists who were painting landscapes for a living and selling them in postcards, to protect them from the owners of the facades of a building coming to them and saying, well, now you're selling your postcards, you know, you're earning a meager living doing this, but I own that building, I deserve royalties to the postcards that you painted and sold. So, you know, that's not protecting the artist's rights. It's deeply unfortunate when that happens. That's why the Austrians invented this law in the 1800s. A tourist shoots their vacation video, uploads it to YouTube. Let's say they shoot it in the waterfront, in Nobel Square, where the statues of the Nobel laureates are, recently built monument. They'll need to ask, I assume it's owned by the V&A waterfront. Who do you ask the V&A waterfront? If you do ask the V&A waterfront, I'm pretty sure they'll also stare at you blankly and say, well, what are you talking about? Google Street View. It's another one. I use Google Street View quite a lot, free public service, to find out where I'm going, to make sure that I'm at the right building, at the right place. It's, you know, it helps me navigate around. It's a public benefit service. That also violates, is also in this legal gray area due to a lack of freedom of panorama. Three-dimensional renderings of recently built public works, such as Orlando Stadium. If you're an architecture student, and you want to showcase famous works of South African architecture, and you want to do a three-dimensional print or a rendering of, say, the Orlando Stadium, that's also the same problem. So naturally, this affects a wide range of people, really covered artists, everyone from painters to craft workers, photographers, full media people, technology companies, we talked about Google and Facebook, it affects us, Wikipedia editors, and the broader general public. That's why we were making a recommendation to insert a Freedom of Panorama clause into the new Copyright Act. Something along the lines of what you see before you. I did realize very recently that what I've suggested here is not full enough, in that if the wording here doesn't allow for three-dimensional renderings, which is why the 360-degree photograph that I mentioned here is poignant. It's a different thing. It's not the same as three-dimensional renderings, but it's the same sort of very modern technology that moving images and representations doesn't cover. So I would actually expand expand it to include sort of all media capturings and renderings. Yeah, that's about it. I'm open to questions.
As I indicated, Mr. Scott, earlier, that we'd be dealing with both yourself and Google, you know, at the same time. Are we all right with that, members, for our comments and our questions and so on? Right. And I was pleased you've got your suggestion here as well in this regard, which we'll take cognizance of. So, members, here it is, 10:15. Let's have your comments, Honourable Williams, questions. Right, we'll start with yourself. Honourable Van Schalkwyk, Honourable McPherson, Honourable Esterhazen, in that order, and Honourable Kalaku.
Thanks, Chair. First, I just want to welcome both the inputs. I just want to talk to Wikimedia. I'm quite shocked at what you've brought to us, what you've told us today, and I would absolutely support a clause like that in this legislation that would legalize me going outside and taking a photograph standing next to the bust of Nelson Mandela, and then, you know, because currently, like you're saying, it seems to be in a grey area, and I could, you know, face a fine or something. So I fully support that, and I hope that the department's paying attention, because we would really like to see this in the a clause like this in the legislation. Thank you. That's all I have to say. Thanks, Jim.
Thank you, Honourable Williams. Honourable Van Schalkwyk.
Thank you, Chairperson. Wikimedia, you were talking about the freedom of panorama that you feel strongly about that need to be included into the bill. But you've also spoken about some areas some kind of inside or outside the building freedom. Which one do you prefer to be included or in the bill in South Africa? In terms of Google, you've mentioned that you have that content ID partners that's more than 8,000, and I assume that it's global partners. But do you have some statistics that in terms of what is happening locally in terms of South Africa, how many partners do you have? And also you spoke about the strikes in terms of your YouTube policies. Does that also apply to criminal videos that, for instance, videos that can promote criminalities and stuff that, like that? And you also have statistics available to show us the percentage-wise in terms of the years. Has it been increasing? Has it been decreasing? And especially bringing it to our continent and also locally in South Africa. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Honourable Van Schalkwyk. Honourable McPherson.
Thanks, Chair. I'm going to do this in a few rounds because I want to focus my attention to Google, but I've got quite a lot of questions for them. Okay. First of all, with regards to the Wikimedia guys, it's absurd and it's... Yeah, that's why we have to continuously review law, because things change as time goes by. So personally, I don't think that your request is unreasonable. With regards to Google, I think that what you've done is give a very interesting presentation, but I think that it needs to be viewed from the context of how Google has developed in a highly advanced democratic country like the United States, and a country that has a highly advanced legal system that has developed over, you know, a few hundred years, and an economy that is way more advanced than ours. I'm not sure that the numbers that you put in front of us are fair to use in a South African context. So with your discussion around fair use, I mean, that's, for me, that's how the discussion needs to be viewed. in that it's viewed through a highly advanced economy where people have, creators have access to capital, access to resources to promote their works, unlike in South Africa where that is not possible. And for me, without the protection of that work, that is the only form of asset that they have to assist in raising capital, to promote it, to advance it, and to use it fairly. You spoke about a lot of sort of fear-mongering, and that's the second time I've heard that word. And when I hear similar terminology between presenters, it worries me that there are discussions being taking place, you know, outside of this open and transparent forum. So could you just advise me, does Google pay lobby groups to advance their arguments outside lobby groups? And are any of those groups have presented to us or coming to present to us? I think that's an important question, and I'd like you to tell me who those are, if indeed that is a practice that you do. With respect to your numbers of, what was this page up? The clean results for popular queries. And you cited the Sweet Home Alabama point. But your after screenshot still includes, on as the third most popular hit, a download MP3 for free. So if you've taken down 2.8 billion, I just want to get to that number, 2.8 billion copyright or infringement or removals, is that on request, or has that been through your algorithms which search for copyright or pirated information? Because if it is on request, how has that got through your algorithms that run? And then I'd also just like to understand the discussions that took place between yourselves, and I just want to refer to my notes, so if you don't mind.
At this moment, you need to conclude
sure.
In the next 30 seconds.
Sure. Between yourselves and rights holders in the UK, and why the UK government had to negotiate the codes of good practices between yourselves and them, if it is, as you've pointed out, sort of an obvious, you know, service that you provide in removing illegal or pirated content. And then finally,
indeed, thanks, Honourable Macpherson. No, it's because this is so broad, you see. Honourable Easterhazen.
Madam Chair, Mr. Zibanda, Google has become a way of life for all of us. South Africa, however, has already has legislation dealing with public funded research. The IP rights or Public Finance Research and Development Act of 2008 is a very good policy, and it brings about certainty in the IP environment and gives incentives to universities to commercialize public funding research. Public funding research is what led to Google's groundbreaking techniques. Giving this amendment, the Copyright Act, and I see Dr. Schoenwetter sitting at the back there, and I hope he agrees with me. He's an expert in IP, University of Cape Town. Universities will now lose the government copyright and the works of academics and employees, and the same will apply to every other institution that receives funding from the state. Now homegrown Google will emerge in South Africa. Section 3 of the bill proposes to vest copyright of any works funded by or created under the direction of the state and government. That's very scary for institutes like that.
Thank you, Honourable Esterhazen. Honourable Kalaku?
Chair, to adjust this, maybe it might be a comment and a question. It's very interesting, your explanation, that is Google, your presentation and your examples, because as a country, we are influenced by best practices around. Firstly, I would want to get your view, because if I follow your presentation, especially around fairness and around, as you have explained thoroughly to us, your view seems to me closer, that is Google's views, very much closer to the presentation which we have just received. Of course, I would agree with your proposals, because we're taking for granted that if I go to union buildings, I take a photo, I don't have to, there's no law which I must be actually begin to fear that will interfere. So maybe in your suggestion, we might consider it maybe add or redefine it. But it's a valid suggestion. So I want to get from Google, what is your comment on South Africa in its bill, in its act, having a clause or inserting the freedom of panorama you actually proposed. But I think that I'm sure I know the role players in the industry, since the bill have been published, all of them were lobbying. Everybody was lobbying for their own interests and positions. I don't think that it will be fair for us just to put it to you. Of course, you can clarify that. And I think that's something which you'll want to know from all those who have presented here. Because everybody was lobbying, and you lobby each other, of course. And if you look as I was reading your presentations, even if I was not here, you could see some of them, they have met, they have discussed their positions, where they agree and where they don't agree. So one question I would want to, as you have said, Google, one question, the rejection around those who reject some of the clauses, or some of them saying those amendments are not correct, is around ownership, the copyrights. Between those who are originators of these ideas and creators, and those who actually are users, and those who actually commercialize and put money on them. So that's where I think the crux of the matter around the bill is. And of course, with the element which the department is inserting, is a department position, is not a government position yet. Don't mistake. When you see us, you must look in those officials, not to us, of wanting to interfere with contractual arrangements, as you are putting in your submissions. I'll want your comment on that, on those areas. Thank you,
Honourable Kalaku. I think that was all of you. Yes, taken account of. All members. I just have one or two points here, perhaps a comment. I'm not aware if others on the committee were aware that of the point you raise here, guard against abuse, we were all very much aware of piracy, etc. But I, for one, was not aware that, you know, there was this principle operating where you could, as it were, claim that this was your work in order just to prevent it being published, as it were. I think that's something we've got to take greater account of. The other points one would like to refer to are the 600 years here. Content ID operates at a massive scale. Where you speak of more than 600 years of audio and visual reference content. Clearly, Google was not here 600 years ago, so you're talking of another spatial dimension. Hopefully, that's not the fifth. And then there is the other point here that is made on fair dealing and fair use. Now, members may correct me, but I don't recall at this point of hearing about a hybrid approach. I've heard of, you know, there's the fair use principle, etc., and how that is used, and the fair dealing. But you've come up here, Google, with a point that says a hybrid approach has a list of defined exceptions plus an open one to provide certainty and flexibility. I'm not aware of that coming up on Tuesday or earlier, and that's quite helpful to hear from yourself. With respect to Wikimedia, is it? I'm very concerned at what I see as a continuing legacy of colonialism in this panorama issue, where you'd be allowed to carry on with all these colonial images and apartheid images, but not bring about the newer ones. I am concerned, DTI. I hope we've covered that. Thank you. Right, over to yourself.
And thank you very much for that. I'm going to answer the... I know you didn't address the question about fear to me, as to Google, I suspect that I'm the cause of that one indirectly or directly. There was an event last week in Johannesburg, a public forum, which I attended, and I was actually sitting next to a representative from Google at the time, coincidentally, where I gave a honest analysis. It was a personal analysis. It was not an analysis of Wikimedia South Africa, because I'm only here on Wikimedia's behalf to talk about Freedom Panorama. But on a personal level, it was my observation that there was a lot of misunderstanding, and which I could only interpret at the time as fear, coming from a place of fear. In the Wikimedia movement, we're encouraged to assume good faith, and that's our assumption, is that it came from a place of good faith, this fear over fair use, but it was an observation based on a misunderstanding. In regards to, back to Freedom Panorama, regards to interior and exterior images, put the map back up again of Freedom Panorama regulation around the world. The ideal is to have both interior and exterior. I don't know of a country that has only interior Freedom Panorama and no exterior ones, but there are quite a few that have only exterior ones. Ideally, we would have both interior and exterior, public interiors and public exteriors. I agree with the chairperson. I actually used the term last week. It's perverse that we can't put photographs of more recent monuments and more recent places to illustrate them, apart from being deeply unfortunate and tragic. And our hands are tied in this because, as a policy, the Wikipedia community, we take the strictest possible interpretation of copyright law. So that's why the fair dealing, fair use allowances just aren't good enough for us. In addition to the impact that the lack of Freedom Panorama has on the general public. I'm gonna leave it at that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. I had quite a few questions that I got. I hope I'll be able to deal with all of them. I'll start with the Honourable Van Skalvik. You said you talked about the partnerships that we have. What about South Africa? As I said at the beginning of my presentation, unfortunately, I do not have South Africa-specific numbers or details, but our partnerships are global. Remember, some of the companies, some of the rights holder companies around the world are actually represented here. Some of them have actually already presented in the South African Parliament. They've got local offices, they've got local allies, and all of that. So remember, even if it looks like it's 8,000 partners, these partners represent millions of creators because they are rights holders for many other artists. It's not 8,000 people, it's millions behind them. And I think that's important. And then in terms of YouTube, I limited my presentation to copyright issues. But YouTube is a platform where we've got policies and guidelines around any sort of content. We have appeared in Parliament talking about other contents, such as violent content, such as teen suicide, such as cyberbullying for kids, such as child sexual abuse imagery. So all of that content is content that's not allowed on our platform. So if you sign up to the platform, you're actually taken through these stages for you to know what you can post and what you cannot post. So we've got many other responses to many other forms of illegal content, as you put it, that we respond to on YouTube other than just copyright. So it's a very extensive curriculum that we have. And then Honourable McPherson, you mentioned that the numbers that I'm putting are not fair in the South African context. Again, I'll go back to the fact that due to us being a global company, we are citing global figures. But I'm not also citing these figures so as to intimidate or to show off. I'm citing this to show what the possibilities are. And I think if we want to make legislation, you have said that these things may apply to more advanced countries. I think if we want to make legislation, we must make legislation that is future-proof. South Africa may not be advanced right now, but who's to say in the digital era South Africa cannot be advanced in the next 3, 4 years, or 5 years, or 20 years, I don't know how long it could take. So I think when we make legislation, we must think of the future. We must not just think of now, because we don't want to come back again after 3 years and try to change our copyright law because now South Africa is an advanced country. I think we are going towards, in terms of trends in technology in the digital era, this is, I think, generally where everyone is going. And I think South Africa is better placed if you come up with legislation that looks into the future as well to try and address some of these things or innovations that may come in the future, but we're not yet aware of them now. And then when you talk to about the issue of access to capital and resources, it's the same issue that I've had before, that fair use, for example, is only works in highly litigious countries. I've shown some slides here which showed that between 2009 and 2017, there were only 9 cases, legal cases of fair use in the US. And also, remember, as I've said, we are setting up a tribunal under this bill to adjudicate or actually sit through some of these issues that may arise. I don't potentially think that it's going to open a can of worms to litigation and it's only going to privilege a few. I don't think that's how it's going to go. And then the issue of fear-mongering, I don't know, I may have stolen the phrase from someone, but I was sitting here actually on the first day of the hearings, and that's the feeling that I got. That was my genuine interpretation of what was happening. Apologies if it offended. But also I want to emphasize that there is no, your question at the end was, are we paying any lobbyists? No, we're not. We're not paying any lobbyists. Our position as Google on the issues on most legal or policy development positions in South Africa are put forward by us, and most of the times it's me. We can have allies that share the same views that could say more or less the same things, but at the end of the day, there is no hidden like agenda where we pay people to say anything. And I think it's fair, as the other honourable member said, that there could be people that will come here and say more or less the same things. Maybe we should also ask if they're being paid or they are colluding. But from our side, my presentation was strictly for Google and from Google. We haven't paid anyone to say the same things as ours. There's actually a series of workshops and roundtables that we did in the run-up to these hearings, in which we also invited Parliament, we invited other stakeholders from civil society to rights holders, to private sector, to technology companies, to academia, to librarians, just to talk about this bill before we come to Parliament. And almost everyone there, we had very robust debates, very differing views. Almost everyone there was allowed to present. Some of the guys are presenting here as well. They were speaking at these roundtables. And that is by no means, it's just allowing democracy to flourish and debate to flourish. It's by no means lobbying or paying some people to say some things. To the search results, the clean search results, I think it's an unfortunate act of my laziness, because those screen grabs, if you actually look at it, they're still using the old Google logo before we changed. Actually, as you were talking, I went to Google search and I typed Sweet Home Alabama. I request you to type right now on your phone and see the results. Actually, it's much, much cleaner than what I put up there. In fact, when you look at the first, I think up to 10 links, there is nothing there that will link it to pirate sites or anything. It's really all, it's clean results to legit websites. That screen grab was probably from an old search result, as you can see with the old logo. And then the discussions between Google and the rights holders in the UK. Also on the search results thing, I think it's important, as I said, that this is work in progress. We are improving on it. We are not saying this is perfect. This will solve all the world's problems. It's what we keep trying to improve on, as we know. So it's a combination of people reporting and also a combination of our algorithms, machine learning, as we go. Because pirate sites, they change. You know, they shift change, they change the form, and they always try to, you know, run away. But we're learning as we go and we're improving as we go. It's never the final solution.
We need to close off this part of the session, and there were still a few more questions.
There's a few more questions. Honourable S. Jason, I'm sorry, I didn't understand the question around public financing and universities losing the right. Yeah.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Section 3 of the bill proposed to vest copyright of any works funded by or created under the direction of the state or government. This amendment to the copyright, now universities will lose to government the copyright of works of academics and its employees. Section 5 also speaks of ownership that's funded. Filmmaking, for example, every filmmaking Section 5, if you look wherever it's in some way funded by government through SABC or whatever way, and filmmakers will lose the copyright to whatever film they make as a simple example.
Okay. Apologies, Comrade. Sorry. Honourable S. Jason,
I can't even go on mic when there are two mics out.
I think, apologies, we limited our submission, even the one that we the oral one that we put in, we limited our submission to only those instances which I thought would be better covered by us as a technology company. I think on that issue of funding for research for filmmakers or for universities, I think it's best explained by those guys that are in that sector. We can't talk for them. That's why I didn't answer that. And then the last few questions I got was, what do I think of the proposal that Wikimedia is saying? We fully support it. We've got a product called Street View. Actually, when I heard about the lack of freedom of panorama in this bill, my eyes actually popped, because our Street View could be violating, I don't know, 6 million copyright infringements as we speak today. We fully support that proposal from Wikimedia. And then maybe the last thing that I want to talk about is the issue of fair dealing and fair use. We are saying this really is a question of wording, because fair dealing is closed list of exceptions. In that closed list of exceptions, if you put a phrase, a simple phrase, as such as, for example, it opens up the exceptions and then it becomes fair use. So we are saying, personally, at Google, we would prefer fair use and open list of exceptions, which includes that phrase, such as, because it doesn't limit us to some of the things that we may not be thinking about today. There could be other things in future. So we're saying leave it open, but in the event that the bill wants a hybrid approach, it's also fine. Yeah.
Thank you. Wikimedia, anything? Right. I did recognize Honourable MacPherson as having an extra point. Honourable Esther Hazen, I am going to allow you, but not on the same point, because it would appear that that is not their field, and we can ask someone else who's coming up after tea, but you will be given the opportunity. Honourable MacPherson.
Thanks. Let me just rephrase my question. Are there any organisations that have presented or are presenting that receive any form of funding, whether it's $1 or $100 from Google? Not necessarily they get paid to come here. Are there any organizations that receive any form of funding whatsoever? Just out of interest, I mean, if you go and Google Pirate Bay on Google, it actually comes up with the site Pirate Bay, and then under that, where to go and find pirate sites. So I'm not sure that, you know, this idea of the algorithms, picking up pirate sites is necessarily fireproof and still opens up for pirated work to be accessed through Google. But I think that one of the main things that this bill is going to hinge on is going to be fair dealing versus fair use. And, you know, I think that that the idea of fair use in the United States is something that has sat on, you know, legal, you know, jurisprudence over a number of decades. And so I'm not terribly convinced where you say that only 7 trials of fair use were brought between 2009 and 2016 is the whole picture. Because you have case law that has developed over decades in the United States, and so it just means that less cases would be brought forward because there would be less reasons to do so. And, you know, when that system is imported into a country like ours that doesn't have that case law, you're going to have hundreds, if not thousands, of cases before a tribunal that, quite frankly, is not going to be, you know, resourced to deal with all of those. So I'm not personally convinced on the idea of fair use yet.
Thank you, Honourable MacPherson. Honourable Esther Hazen.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'd say that any research institution that receives funding from government will lose to copyright. So there will be no homegrown Google or anything going forward in this country giving that disincentive. Thank you.
Could I just check on something? Composers, Authors, Publishers Association, are you here? Just yourself? You're right, okay. The Freedom of Expression, the Kagiso Media, the South African Guild of Editors. You're still busy editing, are you? Right, okay. Because what is going to happen then, we're trying to get hold of them, I'm sure, through Mr. Hermans. We'll start off afterwards with Freedom of Expression and Kagiso coming up after tea break, okay? Do continue now, Mr. Scott, and Google, please.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. So on the issue of funding, I'm not exactly sure I understand it, But we, Google as a company, not just on copyright issues, but we work with a lot of partners. So for example, we work with Media Monitoring Project, where we are running a program called Web Rangers to teach children about online safety in schools. And that program is funded by us, the Department of Communications, MTN, I forget who else is there, but it's a bunch of guys that are funding. And I think MMA is going to be presenting later today. I don't know if that is what the question is, but in particular, there is no one who's been funded to say anything around fair use. Oh, it's not your question. Oh, yeah. We work with many partners, including government departments, including private sector, including civil society, on many issues from protecting children, online to digital literacy. We're partnering with DTPS. There are so many people that we partner with. So I don't know if that answers the funding question. It doesn't? Sorry.
Next
question. Let me be even more clear than previous. Have any organizations that have come before us, and you said that there's one to come, do any of them receive funding from Google? That's my question.
Does it matter on what matters that they receive funding? Oh, say Media Monitoring Africa. Okay.
Yep. So you're fine, that's it. Does that respond to the question? Right, okay. So right. What we're going to do at this point, yes, I'm very cognizant of that, Honourable Williams. We are going to have one moment, because I don't want to see a set stampede. There will be tea outside. Members should take tea first. Unfortunately, we don't have time. We're going to put those in writing. You heard what I said to the previous people, that we're going to see whether or not we may have to bring people back. So right now, we will put these further questions to you in writing. You will respond in writing. And should we need to consult you further, Mr. Hermans will contact you. So please, all of you, remain available. This is a serious and complex bill before us. Thank you. Members, do avail yourselves of tea. Thank you. And it is now 10 to 11. Please be back at 11.